Okay. Welcome to the APTA Vestibular SIG monthly podcast. My name is Ethan Hood, and this podcast is going to be on BPPV variants. Today we have a wonderful guest speaker. We have Dr. Jana Chominski, who is a physical therapist, and she is a professor at Midwestern University. Thank you for coming today, Janet.
Thank you.
Now, Janet, could you give us a little background on your experience, please?
Sure. I'm a professor of physical therapy at Midwestern University. I received my PhD from Northwestern University's Institute for Neuroscience from the Department of Neurobiology and Physiology. My PhD is in ocular motor control. I have received NIH funding investigating strategies to reduce dizziness in older adults, and currently my research interests are prevention of recurrence of BPPV, evaluation and treatment of atypical BPPV, and of central adaptation of the vestibular system.
Great, great. So can you explain to us what exactly BPPV is?
BPPV is a mechanical disorder of the inner ear, and it's caused by abnormal stimulation of one or more of the three semicircular canals. And initially, it was reported that 87% of BPPV was due to posterior canal involvement. But more recent literature is suggesting that it's more like 41 to 65% of BPPV involves the posterior canal. 20% involves multi-canal BPPV. As high as 21 to 33% involves the lateral canal. And it's been reported recently as high as 17% of BPPV is anterior canal.
Wow.
So when you're evaluating somebody, you know, you need to try to determine which canal is involved.
Okay. Is there a specific demographic that is usually affected?
Usually, you tend to see women having more involvement than men. The ratio is 2 to 1. The incident of BPPV increases with each decade of life, and the peak incident occurs around the 6th, 7th decade of life.
Okay. Are there certain diagnoses that are associated with BPPV?
If you have a history of migraines, you're 4 times more likely to have BPPV. If you have osteoporosis, there is an association with BPPV, but nobody has ever seen a direct link.
Okay.
If you have thyroiditis, there is an association, but again, there is no direct correlation.
Okay. And there's association with head injury as well, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And now, in your practice, what is the most common form of BPPV that you see?
The most common cause of BPPV in my practice is unknown, and
okay.
Greater than 50% is unknown. The majority of my patients that I see have posterior canal BPPV, but I see a lot of atypical BPPV just because I work in the Chicago area, and if patients aren't getting better, I get a lot of referrals from other PTs.
Okay. So as far as the signs and symptoms that you see with the patients, what do you usually see?
Well, in terms of signs and symptoms, usually when a patient comes in, if you look at their history, usually they complain of getting dizzy if they look up, and a lot of times that's referred to as top shelf syndrome. They'll complain of dizziness when they get out of bed, if they move their head quickly, when they roll over in bed, and it's critical that you ask them towards which direction do they get dizzy, and a lot of times they're not able to tell you, and you have to kind of figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
They'll complain of getting dizzy if they bend, and if they tell you that they get dizzy when they're reading the newspaper in the morning, when they're eating breakfast,
mm-hmm.
That usually indicates that they have anterior canal involvement. And usually, if you have vertical canal involvement, they're not going to complain of dizziness when they're up and walking. But if they complain of dizziness when they're walking, and particularly when they're turning their head to check for traffic, when they're
mm-hmm.
crossing the street, or when they're driving and they're checking their mirrors, they complain of dizziness. That's usually a sign of lateral canal involvement.
Okay. So as far as the textbook history that you actually see, it's just generally a short-term duration vertigo that you
correct.
See, with possible, depending on their age, they might complain of imbalance as well, correct?
Correct. It's usually they complain of brief episodes of vertigo, usually lasting less than a minute. They might complain of a swimming sensation in between changes in position of the head, and that's just telling you how severe they are, or they might complain of a lightheadedness. But usually it's a brief episode of vertigo.
Okay. All right. Now, as far as the specific tests that you would do to diagnose someone with BPPV, what is the gold standard test out there, or is there one?
Yes, there is. According to the clinical practice guidelines of the American Academy of Otolaryngology and the practice parameters by the American Academy of Neurology that were put out in 2008, for a diagnosis of BPPV, the diagnosis is based on the history and the findings on positional testing. And the gold standard for positional testing is the Dixtal-Pike maneuver.
Okay.
So the Dixtal-Pike test is sensitive for detecting BPPV in the vertical canals, and you may or may not detect BPPV in the lateral canals. And if you suspect lateral canal involvement, then you need to do a supine roll test, and you need to do some variant of positional testing in the pitch plane or forward and backwards in sitting to try to lateralize which canal is involved.
Okay, interesting. Now, prior we discussed a little bit about whether or not to classify in the canalithiasis or cupolithiasis in terms of the different variants of BPPV. Can you explain that when you see someone with BPPV, what exactly you're looking at and what determines you to make the official first treatment that you would do?
When I look at a patient, to me the most important thing is to identify which canal is involved. So I want to look at the direction of the nystagmuses during the Dixtal-Pike test and possibly during the supine roll test and the forward roll test. So I want to make sure that they're not on any medication that is going to suppress the nystagmus.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're on Valium or if they're on Meclizine, that will suppress the nystagmus and you may not see it. Or if you work in a clinic that doesn't use goggles, they may visually fixate and use smooth pursuit to suppress the nystagmus and you may not see anything. So you need to use goggles. You need to look at what medications the person is on. And you may have to request that the person be off of the medications in order to effectively evaluate them. When it comes to determining if it's cupulolithiasis or canalithiasis, I'm really not that concerned about it because aside from the lateral canal, it doesn't really modify what I do relative to treatment. And the mechanisms in terms of cupulolithiasis and canalithiasis were proposed based on what they found in postmortem temporal bones and what they observed during surgery. And then what they did is there were researchers who came up with mathematical models that incorporated fluid dynamics to try to see if they could model cupulolithiasis and canalithiasis. And what they found was they could. And so with cupulolithiasis, because the debris is stuck to the cupula, usually there is no latency of onset to the nystagmus. It usually builds up gradually over time and peaks at about 20 seconds. Usually it's of a longer duration. And if you have a given weight of otoconium, the amplitude of the nystagmus will be a third, or it will be dampened if it's on the cupula, as opposed to if it's in the long arm of the canal. So in theory, if you saw no latency of onset and you saw low amplitude and long duration, in theory it would be cupulolithiasis.
Okay.
With canalithiasis, you may or may not see a latency of onset. If the debris is in the ampulla, the amount of time that it takes for the debris to transverse the ampulla and go into the long arm of the canal will create your latency of onset. If the debris is in the long arm of the canal, when you're in the process of dropping the head back into the Dixtal-Pike, you'll see a onset of a nystagmus. You might not ever even get into the full position of the Dixtal-Pike, even though you're going to put the person into that position. And if you have, what they found is that if you have small particles for a given weight, you're going to have longer latencies and a longer duration of response than if you have a single particle of the same total mass, where it will have a shorter latency and it will be a very brief burst of nystagmus. And so if you look at this, if you have small particles that are in the long arm of the canal, you may have no latency of onset, and it may last for a long duration.
Okay.
If it's stuck on the cupula, you may have no latency of onset, and it could be long duration. So you can't really say this is cupulothiasis or this is canalothiasis. But the other thing that's of interest is if you have debris within the long arm of the canal, it'll take 25 seconds for it to transverse 90 degrees of the canal. And if the otoconium is in constant contact with the wall, it won't create enough drag for you to end up seeing nystagmus, even though the debris is within the canal.
Interesting. Now, if you're going to treat, so let's not break in the cupulothiasis or canalothiasis. If we're going to treat posterior canal BPPV, what, in your expertise, what is the typical treatment that you do then?
If you look at the literature, we did a systematic review that was published in 2010 in PTJ. And if you look at the literature, the short-term outcome for the canal 3 positioning procedure and the liberatory maneuver is the same. It's roughly 80%. And the canal 3 positioning procedure, the findings are based on randomized controlled trials, and the liberatory maneuver is based on quasi-randomized controlled trials. But still, if you look at them, the outcome is the same. And if you look at the canal 3 positioning procedure, if you're in the United States, we feel more comfortable using the CRP. So that will be our, usually most clinicians will use that as their first choice. If you're in Europe or you're European trained, their first choice will be the liberatory maneuver, and their outcomes will be the same. So my feeling is whatever you're comfortable with, if you're comfortable with the liberatory maneuver, if you're comfortable with the canal 3 positioning procedure, that should be the procedure that you try first. And then if that doesn't work, you can use a combination of the two to try to optimize your outcomes.
Okay. So when you see someone, how many times would you actually treat them with the CRP or the liberatory maneuver?
Usually if I see them, I will do three cycles of either the CRP or the liberatory maneuver, minimum. And my experience has been is usually the first time I do the maneuver, I'll get maybe 80% of the particles will clear. And then the second time I would do the maneuver, if there's any debris, I'll clear it out. And then if there are silent particles that are moving along the wall of the long arm of the canal, I'll do a third maneuver in order to try to clear it out. I never follow up at the same session with a Dixhell-Pike test, because if you follow up with the Dixhell-Pike test, what you're going to be doing is moving the rocks 90 degrees around the ring, but not moving them the full 360 degrees that is needed to clear.
I gotcha.
So my concern would be that I would dump something out. So I always do a minimum of three, and depending on how the session is going, I may go more or less.
But essentially you're doing the Dixhell-Pike maneuver as you're doing that CRP anyway, correct?
Correct.
Is that the, okay. Now, if you see someone and you're treating them and you're doing the CRP on them and you notice that the after doing the CRP one time on the second time, if their nystagmus and their symptoms are exactly the same as the first time, would you change your treatment in any way? Would you go to the liberatory maneuver then?
Definitely.
Okay.
The canal 3 positioning procedure uses gravity to move the rocks around the canal, and the liberatory maneuver uses inertia. So if I was doing the canal 3 positioning procedure and I wasn't seeing any change, if I knew the person and I knew that they weren't sensitive in terms of I might get an autonomic response and might get vomiting, I would be more aggressive and I would switch my technique to the liberatory maneuver.
Okay.
And I would do a minimum of two cycles of the liberatory maneuver, because I think the first time you do a liberatory maneuver on a patient, they have to kind of learn what it is that you want them to do. And then the second time, you can get a fast enough speed of under 1.5 seconds of flipping them from one side to the other side. It's high enough to get the rocks to move around the ring to try to clear it out.
Okay. Now, are you going to offer them a self-treatment as well? The CRP is traditionally you can do a self-treatment at home.
Yes.
Do you offer the laboratory as a self-treatment at home as well?
Again, it depends on the patient. If it's the first time I've seen them and I'm not sure how sensitive they're going to be, I will not give them home exercise programs, and I'll send them home, and I'll, I still use activity restrictions. I'll have them sleep slightly elevated and sleep on their back and on their uninvolved side. And I'll follow up with what type of a response they have.
Okay.
In 10% of people, they will feel worse following the treatment for up to 24 hours, and I want to find out if this is going to be one of those people. If they do well and they can follow directions when they come back in, then what I would do is I would do a combination of treatment in the clinic and then self-treatment at home.
Okay.
And the literature shows that the best outcomes are when you do a combination of treatment in the clinic and treatment at home.
Okay. Now, as far as anterior canal BPPV, what exactly are you going to see on exam?
If you have anterior canal BPPV, you know, you have to remember that the initial ampullary segment is almost vertical. It's at 70 degrees from the horizontal. So you can evoke nystagmus in both the head right and the head left position of the Dixtal pike. So in 50% of your patients, you're going to see a pure downbeating nystagmus in both the head right and the head left position,
mm-hmm.
and you're not going to be able to determine which ear is involved. In the other 50%, you'll see a downbeating nystagmus with a very small torsion, and the torsion will be towards the ear that's involved.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see the torsion in both the head right and the head left position, again, because of the orientation of that initial ampullary segment.
Okay. So how are you going to determine which side, if 50% of the population has downbeating nystagmus and you can't really, it's hard to determine which side actually has BPPV?
Then you hedge.
Okay.
And what I would do is I would treat them with one of the maneuvers that is designed to treat the anterior canal. And what I would do is I would do just pure neck extension. And
okay.
we first described this, Helminski and Hain, in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is it's very simple. You just take them in long sitting on a table and drop their head back into a minimum of 60 degrees of extension,
mm-hmm.
and you maintain that position for about 2 minutes, and then you sit them back up and you repeat it 3 times. And a lot of times the debris will clear, and you don't have to worry about trying to determine which side is involved. If you know the side that's involved based on the direction of the torsion,
mm-hmm.
when you're in the head right and head left position of the Dixtal pike,
mm-hmm.
or you tried neck extension, it didn't work, and based on their history, you suspect that it's one ear and not the other ear, then what I would do is a forward 360-degree rotation around the anterior canal, which is very similar to the canal 3 positioning procedure
mm-hmm.
for the posterior canal, but it's different in that it's done with the person prone on elbows, and they lean over the table and rotate their head 360 degrees and then end up sitting up, right?
Okay.
And it was first described by Felden and Bronstein in 2008.
Okay. When they're prone on their elbows, how much flexion is their neck in during that maneuver?
Well, what you do is you start prone on elbows,
mm-hmm.
and if I'm treating, let's say, the left side, what I would do is rotate my head 45 degrees to the right and drop my down onto my stomach with my head looking under the table, and I always
okay.
jokingly tell them to look for gum. And then you turn your head 90 degrees so that you're in 45 degrees rotation to the left,
mm-hmm.
and then you roll over maintaining the orientation of the canal relative to gravity
mm-hmm.
So that you end up into basically a left Dixtal pike position, and then from that position you end up sitting up, and you repeat it 3 times. And what
okay.
you're doing is you're rolling the debris 360 degrees around the ring.
Okay. Now, what's the treatment efficacy of that maneuver?
Pardon?
What's the treatment efficacy for that maneuver?
I cannot tell you the treatment efficacy, but I can tell you it works. So I don't have the stats on it.
Anecdotally, it works well, right?
Anecdotally, it works well. I like
okay.
that.
Now, is there any danger to with someone with anterior canal BPPV treating them with a CRP, or is it just not going to be as effective as doing the
it's
other maneuver?
Danger. It's effectiveness. So if you have an older person and you're concerned about putting them in these positions, positions, which you should be, you always need to clear the neck and you always need to clear the vertebral artery before you do any maneuvers for the posterior canal, the anterior canal, or the lateral canal. But you can, if I had to select a treatment that was designed for the posterior canal and apply it to the anterior canal, I would use the modified liberatory maneuver. And again, I haven't found it to be as effective. I found the other two to be effective, but if it's an older person, they can tolerate it with their neck.
Okay. Now, with the other maneuvers, would you offer that as a self-treatment as well for the anterior canal?
I would do the neck extension. They can support their neck on the back of the bed, and so it ends up being very effective. If they had somebody who came in with them that could guide them through the 360, I would have them do the 360 forward roll.
Okay. Okay. Now, on to horizontal canal BPPV. What are you going to see with horizontal canal BPPV?
With horizontal canal BPPV, it has to be bidirectional changing. So when you do the supine roll test and you bring the person down on their back, when their head is turned to the right and then their head is turned towards the left, you should see a reversal in direction. So if when the head is turned to the right, it's geotrophic, it's beating towards the floor, it's right beating. When you turn their head towards the left, it should reverse direction and it should become left beating and still remain geotrophic. It also has to reverse direction in the pitch plane or it's not coming from the lateral canal. So when the person is sitting upright, if they, let's say they have a pseudo-spontaneous left-beating nystagmus, when they bring their head forward, so they drop it 60 degrees forward, that should reverse direction and should be coming a right-beating nystagmus. If you don't see that reversal, it's not lateral canal BPPV.
Okay. Now, what if you see ageotropic nystagmus in the roll test?
You could see, I just used geotrophic as the example.
Okay.
You could also see apogeotrophic BPPV. And what would happen is when you were on your back with your head turned to the right, it would beat away from the earth, so it would be left beating. And when you turned your head towards the left, again, it would beat away from the earth, so it would be right beating. And the same thing would happen when the person was sitting up, that when they were sitting upright, again, if they had a pseudo-spontaneous nystagmus and it was left beating, when they brought the head forward, it would reverse and become right beating.
Okay. Now, what's the difference between ageotropic and geotropic nystagmus in terms of the type of BPPV that it is?
That's a really good question. With lateral canal BPPV, it's very important that you determine whether or not the debris is on the side of the long arm of the canal or whether or not it's on the side towards the utricle near the vestibule. And if the debris is in the long arm, you will see geotrophic BPPV, and you treat it with a log roll, a 360-degree log roll, although we found in the clinic with experience that it's best to go with a 270 roll instead of a 360 roll in order to avoid dumping back into the canal.
That means when you're prone, you just come back up to sitting then, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. With the apogeotrophic BPPV, if it's apogeotrophic BPPV, it could be in the initial segment, ampullary segment of the canal, or it could be attached to the cupula. And if it's in the initial ampullary segment, you can convert it from apogeotrophic to geotrophic BPPV, where you just shift it from the ampullary segment into the long arm of the canal. If it's on the side towards the utricle, you can't canal convert it. So if you have apogeotrophic BPPV, the new maneuver that we've been using that I really like is called the Cupulola three-positioning maneuver. That was described by Kim, Joe, Chung, Bion, and Leff in 2011. And what it does is it's very similar to the log roll, but it treats both the long arm side and it treats the side towards the utricle. And then when you're done with the maneuver, you end up having the person sleep on their uninvolved side, which is opposite of what the Italians recommend with their forced prolonged positioning for apogeotrophic BPPV. Their reported success rate is 97%.
Wow.
And with the patients that we have tried in the clinic, we have gotten 100% with it.
Can you describe that maneuver, how you go through it exactly?
Yes, I can. If you are, if the person is, let's say that they have BPPV and it's involving the right side, and you determined that by when they were sitting up, you saw a pseudospontaneous nystagmus towards the right, or when you did the supine roll test, it was the side of the least intense nystagmus.
Mm-hmm.
So if you determine that the right ear is involved, you put the person on a mat table, sit them in long sitting,
mm-hmm.
have them lay straight down on their back. You maintain that position. They keep each position for 3 minutes.
Okay.
With me, that's not realistic, so I tend to keep them in each position for a minute. So you bring them straight back just to try to get the debris to settle within the canal.
Is there a certain speed you bring them back, or is it just basically just kind of lying down quickly?
Whatever the person can tolerate.
Whatever the person can tolerate, okay.
Speed doesn't matter as much as final position does.
Okay.
So as long as you can comfortably get them down, you're okay. Then what they do is they have them, if I'm treating the right side, you roll onto the right side and then turn the head 45 degrees down towards the floor. And you have them maintain that position. They reported 3 minutes, but I do it for 30.
Mm-hmm.
And you vibrate over the mastoid of the involved ear, and you can use a handheld shower massager, or some people have been using their cell phones on vibration. Then what you do is you maintain you continue laying on your right side, and you turn your head 45 degrees towards the left, so you're in neutral rotation. You
mm-hmm.
maintain that position. Then you roll back onto your back.
Mm-hmm.
Then you maintain that position. Then you roll over onto the left side with, again, neutral rotation, and you put the vibrator behind the right mastoid. Then you roll over onto your stomach, and then from that position, without extending the neck, you push up. And, again, each position is maintained for a minute, and that's my variation of it. And then I would do 3 cycles of it. And like I said, we've been doing it now, and I've had 100% success rate with it.
Would you give it as a self-treatment, or is that something you only do in the clinic?
No, it's something that you could do as a self-treatment.
Okay. Okay, great. Now, here's the question, and I always get this from patients when I'm treating BPPV. What is the reoccurrence rate for BPPV?
The reoccurrence rate is high. And so within a year, the recurrence rate is 25%, and for 2 years, it's 50%. So they're going to come back.
Okay.
And actually, was funded by NIH to see whether or not we could reduce the recurrence rates by doing Brandt Darroff exercises, because that was the exercise that I was doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I found Brandt Darroff exercises weren't effective, I then tried self-administered canal 3 positioning procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was the recurrence rate was the same if they did daily exercises to clean out the ear as if they didn't. So what we do is we recommend positioning where they sleep on the uninvolved side. If they're stomach sleepers, I try to get them to sleep on their back so they don't end up developing anterior canal BPPV.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to teach them what to look for. And then if they have been doing self-treatment exercises and they're good at it, I try to instruct them in what they need to look for to evaluate themselves and to begin self-treatment. And if there is no change, then they need to come in and see us.
Okay. You mentioned Brandt Darroff exercises, and, you know, if you look in the literature, traditionally that was one of the mainstays for treating BPPV. What's the current research and literature show on the Brandt Darroff exercises?
You have to realize that Brandt Darroff exercises are not particle repositioning exercises. They're habituation exercises. So when you're dropping the person down on their side, you're only moving the rocks 90 degrees through the long arm of the canal. And it's been modeled that you need to do a 360-degree roll. So in essence, what you're doing is when you lay the person down, you're just letting the rocks roll 90 degrees, and when they sit back up, they drop back to where they came from. Now, they might work because you're breaking up the particles, but my experience has been if patients do Brandt Deriff exercises, that they can break up the particles and they can end up having canal conversions into the lateral or into the anterior canal. So in order to prevent canal conversion and in order to optimize my outcomes, the current literature is showing that the short-term efficacy of the Brandt Deriff exercises in a week is only 24%, versus the short-term efficacy of the self-canal 3 positioning procedure is 95%. So I would rather give somebody the self-canal 3 positioning procedure because I know my outcome is going to be better at the end of the week, and I have control in terms of where the debris is going, or better control.
Okay. Now, are there any new treatments on the horizon for BPPV?
I am not aware of any. Now there is the Omni Rotator, which is the 360-degree rotator, where if you have somebody who you just can't get rid of the BPPV, that's an option.
Mm-hmm.
And there are gadgets on the market that you fix to the person's head that has usually a tube that's usually filled with water.
It's on a baseball cap usually, right?
Yeah,
okay.
And you can see the bead move to try to make sure that the person gets their head in the right position. But my experience has been, you know, our outcomes are so good with the procedures that are done in the clinic and with the home maneuvers that the more high-tech gadgets at this point really aren't necessary for everybody.
Okay. Now, as far as the OmniAx, can it do any other maneuver besides just the CRP? Can it do all the maneuvers we talked about before?
It can do, you know, it can go, they can treat anterior, they can treat posterior with it, and I'm not sure, but I think they can do lateral with it.
Okay, very interesting. All right, well, Janet, thank you very much for lending your expertise today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay.